This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
This is D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us.
Professor Frank Buckley on Church and Culture again, and for a really special reason. He's got a brand new book out, which he's really surpassed himself. And I can say that as someone who's interviewed him about his three previous books, this will be the fourth. This one is entitled The Republican Workers' Party, How the Trump Victory Drove Everyone Crazy, and Why It Was Just What We Needed. And this is published by Encounter. It came out 2 days ago. Frank Buckley, as you may recall, is a foundation professor at the Scalia School of Law at George Mason University. Frank, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I must say, I got to hand it to you. You pulled off quite a feat with this book. I read it in one sitting. It's about 150 pages long. I think there are special virtues about books of that size, and they can do a particular kind of work and have a particular kind of influence that longer works cannot. Now, did you make this a shorter book on purpose?
Yeah, absolutely, and I totally agree with you. I mean, you know, I guess there's a thought that a really scholarly book has to be, you know, 300-400 pages, but the point is they don't get read. Right, and if you want to keep people's attention, it's got to be shorter.
Well, you kept my attention. In fact, the chapters are all about 5 or 6 pages in length, more or less. And so it makes it easy to sit down, read, and get up and get yourself a sandwich or, you know, put the wet laundry in the dryer or whatever it is you're doing that particular time.
Have but, scotch, maybe?
Right. And but this book just pulls you through, here's what I want us to focus on. You make distinctions in this book that should become part of the public conversation about the election of Trump, its significance, what led up to it, what's continuing to go on. You make distinctions. For example, you know, you call the Republicans the Workers' Party, and to that, you contrast that with what you call the new class, or someone else, you quote someone else, the new class. And you then develop a, for lack of a better word, a taxonomy that runs through economics, education, it runs through culture, it runs through, you even have a kind of an Augustinian overlay. You make some confessions about your own past, which are not sorted, by the way. And also you have a wonderful chapter 16, about the role of religion in American culture and the impact it has when people stop believing their ancient faith. So
yep.
Could we then begin with this distinction you make about the new class, who are not the ultra-wealthy? They aren't the 1%. I think you call them a 10% under that.
Yep. It's the class of professionals, of lawyers, of people who live within the Beltway. In short, I'm describing myself, but then I want to be a traitor to my class. So I know whereof I speak. This is basically the sea in which I swim in. And, you know, they're smart people. They have good work habits. You know, they say they think left and live right. I mean, they often have stable marriages and all that. But there's something missing. And what's missing is a sense of identification with other Americans, which I think is attributed to a decline of nationalism and a decline of religion. Let me give you one, for instance. I was at a workshop yesterday, 2 days ago, and there was some academic who was talking in the most highfalutin way about, you know, the Western civilization, the Western legal system. He had all of these categories, which I didn't understand at all. They didn't explain the thing. And in the end, I said, you know, you're trying to explain what's special about the Western tradition, and you haven't mentioned Christianity. So I said, as you know, what you've done essentially is you've written a history of Bertie Wooster without mentioning Jeeves.
Huh.
And everybody else in the room looked at me as if I had just omitted a particularly unpleasant odor. You know, I
everybody.
Well, you know, all of my colleagues, basically, you know, good libertarians that they are, I had said something that should not be said, right? George Orwell said, you know, in every society, you know, there are things that just shouldn't be said. And he was writing in 1945, and in that case, what should not be said is anything critical of the Soviet Union. And for us today, the thing which should not be said is religion was important in the West, right? Which seems to me blindingly obvious, yeah. You know, Christianity specifically.
Well, you actually say that the Declaration of Independence put into political terms what Christianity provided in its revealed sense.
Yeah. But for them, I mean, for any academic today, what has happened is political history begins with Hobbes or it begins with John Locke, and it is about radical individuals separated from institutions, apart from Leviathan. And it's a sign that the left has won. You know how the left always wanted us to banish religion from political discourse? And the right bought into that. I mean, the intellectual right, the people who were displaced by Trump, essentially, the intellectual right also thought religion should be banished from the public square, right? We're not going to talk about that. And, you know, and the point I wanted to make was, well, if you don't talk about that, not only have you missed everything that was worthwhile in the Western tradition, pretty much, but you're also, you've anesthetized a nerve which needs to be present and felt. And it's a nerve which connects us, well, of course, to God, but to other people as well.
Well, you've cut away
that's
for
gone.
Principles. There are no, you've done what you're
yeah.
operating on assumptions based upon first principles that you're ignoring.
Well, you know, I think what I wanted to do was to describe a very different kind of political tradition and a different kind of liberalism. There are a number of folks around right now who think, who've completely, they're religious people, completely given up on liberalism. And I want to say, no, don't do that, because liberalism is derived from Christianity, you idiot.
Now, this is the old liberalism that you're talking about.
Well, it's the old liberalism, right? But, you know, if you read people like Sir Larry Seidendrop, who talks about, he has a book called Inventing the Individual, right? What made the West different was we derived from our religion the idea that men are radically equal and deserving of respect. And that was something that was completely absent before Christianity in the West and absent in other cultures. I mean, to the extent it's there, we brought it. It was a legacy of our religious tradition.
Well, the liberalism you're talking about includes social conservatism.
Yes, it does. I think what I wanted to do, though, was to say, you know, if you want to think about liberalism, don't think about John Locke. I wanted to connect to something very different, which was my childhood education at the hands of Sisters of Charity.
Yeah, please tell that story. It was very powerfully rendered in your book.
Well, you know, when I was about six or seven, grade one or two, the teachers brought into class a severely, severely retarded child. He would have been a couple of years older than us. He was, I guess, hydrocephalic. He at least had an enlarged head. I mean, he was clearly an idiot, right?
Yes.
And I guess the sisters must have thought that, his parents must have thought that this would be a good experience for the child to mix with other children. And the Sisters of Charity must have thought this would be a good experience for us, the other students. And to my shame, I can't remember the kid's name. He didn't last long with us. I have no idea what happened to him. But what I got from the experience, these little things at last, was the sense that that which connected me to him was as important as that which connects me to anybody else whom I don't know. That is, you know, a sense of common humanity, which was derived from religion. That was the message conveyed by the Sisters of Charity, and it was specifically their instinct of charity, of kindness. So my kind of liberalism goes back to you know, a sense of fellowship with other people, but mostly a sense of kind people. You know, kind people will not act illiberally. And whereas, you know, orthodox ideological liberals can act like beasts, in our experience.
And you actually say that, you know, there's rarely a day goes by that you don't remember that that child.
Yeah. Well, not a month goes by. I mean, it just, you know, it was a very, very powerful experience.
Yeah. And you say, as you look back, a moral failure on your part that has obviously left a deep impression. That's why I called your book partially Augustinian.
Well, it's absolutely Augustinian. I'll tell a tale out of school. I sent something to the First Things magazine, to Rusty Reno, which was explicitly Augustinian. It was about Pascal, and it was rejected on the basis that it was Augustinian, you know, Pascalian. And
What's wrong with that?
Yeah, well, right. Yeah, come on. You know.
I mean, that's where spirituality lies. I mean, that's where.
Yeah.
We, you know, the sort of you know, the Baudelairean, my soul laid bare.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know. You know, religion is, there are some people who come to Catholicism as an intellectual exercise, and there are some people for whom it's simply a substitute for politics, right? You know,
yikes.
You pick your politics and then you yikes. Say, right, you know, I'm conservative, and therefore what religion should I have? And if that's the way you do it, you know what, you haven't joined a religion, right?
I came to Washington out of the academy in the mid-90s. And I was a Catholic, conservative, Republican, and what I found, I'm not really surprised by the rejection, because this, in many places of influence, magazines and think tanks, there's this amalgamation of Catholicism, conservative philosophy, self-conscious conservative philosophy, and, how shall I put it, insiderism.
Mm-hmm.
That creates a bunch of observers, armchair observers on the scene who never engage anything at the level of any kind of danger for themselves.
Yeah. Well, you know, at that level, it's an ersatz religion, right? It's a substitute for politics, whereas, you know, the proper motto for the church was that given by James Joyce, here comes everybody, right? I mean, it's like all kinds. So I've had this experience, and you've had this experience, you know, the grand papal, well, this was at Castle Gandolfo, right? And so there's a papal audience, which is where about, you know, 20,000 people are in attendance.
Right, right.
And you see people with flags from every country in the world. And that's just
brilliant. It's brilliant.
Yeah, that's just the most wonderful thing, right? I guess if you're approaching it as an intellectual experience purely, that wouldn't resonate with you.
So, you know, but Frank, I approach everything as an intellectual experience, but I'm an embodied person. You know, I have a heart and feelings and emotions and passions about what I read and think, and so nothing to me is purely intellectual. I'm not an angel. I'm a man.
Yeah, totally. No, I know. By the way, I joke with people sometimes. I say, I don't have a racist bone in my body. There was this, some of your listeners will remember, a comic series handed out at school called Treasure Chest.
Oh, yeah.
It was specifically Catholic.
Right.
And around, you know, a way long time ago, even before the Civil Rights Revolution, they had a series of covers with Mary in as a person of different races. I thought that was brilliant, right?
Yes.
So, you know, so look, what if the next pope were African or, you know, whatever? It wouldn't matter.
Fine with me as long as he's, you know, the next pope in a hurry.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, but our listeners, after introducing the book and you, our listeners need to know, what was it that Trump put in a bottle, so to speak, trapped in a bottle, that got him elected?
You know, it was a number of things, and one of them was rambunctiousness. I mean, he was, you know, not polite.
He was Pascalian.
Yeah, and so there's some, you know, there's a new book out by Bob Woodward. There's an op-ed in the New York Times, and the gist of it was, you know, the problem with this guy is he eats his peas off his knife, you know, and rubs, you know, all that stuff. In fact, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm saying to myself, yeah, I can see that. This is a president who says things like, why can't we do X? Right? And, you know,
right.
Everybody says X is outrageous. Well, if you're coming to this from the outside, you're not part of the establishment, you want to know what the problem with X is. So you ask the question. There's nothing wrong with asking the question. The trick is with Trump is, well, ask about what the actions that are taken afterwards are. And if they're pretty much okay, testing ideas, thinking outside the box is just
right.
Fine. So
you place the Trump election and all of the post-election trauma inside of a kind of classic class struggle, which has emerged in America over the last few decades, correct?
Absolutely, and it's you know, there are a lot of people who want to relate this to things that have happened in the past. Andrew Jackson, for example, you know, or populists of a more dismal stripe. But Trump's an original, and he's responding to something we've never seen before, which is an opposition party that's given up on America. Right? An opposition party,
right.
Well, in fact, the closest would be 1860. Right? The closest would be people in the North, with, you know, who properly despised slavery and who thought, you know, look, you guys, you slaveholders, you got whatever you want, but we won't give you respect. But we all crave respect. And when Hillary Clinton tells people, as she did, of the deplorables, when she said, you're not America, well, if you're not America, you have to wonder what country you belong to or should belong to, which is why the 1860 parallel is interesting.
Yeah, and you make the point that American public schools no longer teach about the great men and women of America, but they teach about the eras or the struggles or the mistakes that America has made instead.
Yeah. And Trump was completely opposed to that, right? When he said, make America great again, one of the things he was saying was that this historically was a great country, which I think is absolutely accurate. Whereas on the left, the effort has always been to destroy American history, to render it as something, make it look like something contemptible. And so Trump was, you know, a cultural conservative. And
an economic liberal.
And an economic liberal. Well, see, that's what most people don't get about his nationalism, right? Nationalism is something that makes you proud of being American and proud of our history and all the things we've overcome. But it also pulls you to the middle of the road on economics. I mean, you end up...
It pulls you to compassion. You make the point that the difference between the old liberal and the new liberal, and to some extent the new conservative, at least the new libertarian, is that because of the basic principles you're grounded in, which are to a certain extent Christian, you're not going to leave the poor without any safety net, right? You're going to try to take care of people to the extent that's prudent.
Which is something that, you know, the bishops, bless their hearts, have been reminding us of. I mean, they are on economics somewhat left of center, but you know, most Catholics are basically right. I mean, you know, we are not by instinct libertarian, and you ask yourself, how come, right? You know, why is it that libertarians so rightly suspect Catholics? Because they know we can't really quite fit in, because we're coming from a place very different from where they're coming from. I mean, they're coming from a kind of radical individualism, and we're coming from a philosophy, a religion of duty more than of rights. Boy, how much you grew up in a Catholic school, you don't hear the word rights too often. Duty, yeah.
You know, Frank, the first interview I ever did in Washington when I came in 95 was when Robert Novak had a show where he interviewed people, you know, like One Guy a Week. And he brought me in. I was new in town. And one of his first questions was, what do you think of libertarianism? I said, I think it's wrong. And he looked at me, his eyebrows went way up in the middle of his head. And he said, well, a lot of people in town, you know, are very, you know, represent this. And I said, well, you know, Aristotle's Politics and his Ethics were written as one book. And you can't divorce politics from ethics. You know, and Novak loved that. He loved it.
Yeah.
But to me, it's so obvious. How can you try to divorce ethics from public policy?
Right. Well, I put it this way. I say that, you know, libertarians seem to think that the state has no duty whatsoever in terms of looking after ordinary people. And, you know, many libertarians are personally very generous.
Yes, of course.
So the question is, can you make a distinction between your responsibility in terms of personal giving and your responsibility as a citizen voting for a party that supports some form of public welfare support, right? And they want to say, well, I make an absolute distinction between the two. But, you know, I don't think that works, right? And I'll tell you why, right? You don't support the military that way. You can't say, I like the idea of aircraft carriers in the U.S. Navy, and so I'll contribute personally for aircraft carriers. Well, we know that doesn't work. You know that the state's got to come in and supplement private charity in that sense. The same is true of welfare. So, you know, so we don't want to live in a society that looks like, you know, Dickens' London circa 1840, or, you know, It was also Disraeli's East End London of the 1840s, where there were, you know, absolutely wretched people.
Frank, as you explained, not only in this book, but a previous book or two, at the heart of this class struggle is the demise of upward mobility, which you describe in terms of, in this book, in terms of you have the upper 1%, of course, but then you have that new class, 10%, who are comfortable with the lack of mobility because it protects their kids from any competition from below. And this is in some way assured by the fact that our public education has fallen so low in terms of not just Canada, but many other countries in the world.
Yeah, we're a third world country when it comes to K-12, you know. I mean, actually, our universities, for the most part, are nothing to get terribly excited about either. But, you know, when you get down to it, we become immobile to a large extent. Why did we become immobile? Well, both the left and the right want to say it's because of things we can't fix. And I say, fiddlesticks, we become immobile because of policies which essentially protect this new class, which I describe, mostly a very, very left-wing liberal class. So what do? We have a rule of law system which places a stumbling block in the path of people who want to get ahead, but is wonderful for the lawyers of the new class. We have an immigration system which brings in maids and gardeners for the new class, but doesn't bring in people who are going to make ordinary Americans better off. And we have this K-12 system, which is terrible, and where the left is absolutely opposed to anything which looks like school choice. And so you have the paradox that the Democrats run as the party of equality and mobility, but in fact they're responsible for the problems that we have, and they are simply cruel hypocrites.
I want to remind our listeners, I'm talking to Professor Frank Buckley, who's at the Scalia School of Law, George Mason University. His new book, out just a few days ago from Encounter, is entitled The Republicans' Workers' Party, subtitle, gray subtitle, How the Trump Victory Drove Everyone Crazy and Why It Was Just What We Needed. And by the way, on the cover, the just what we needed is all in caps and bolded. I strongly recommend that people read this book for two reasons. One, it's a real insider's look, because Frank was on the inside of the campaign, of how this campaign worked from the inside and how it succeeded. But also, as I said in my review that I put on Amazon today under the book, it points the way forward how the dynamics that were that Trump understood and that Trump addressed enabled him to win, and how it can enable the good guys to win going forward. I'll be back with Frank Buckley. We'll talk more about his new book after this short message.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Ave Maria Radio's fall membership drive begins on Monday, September 10th. And to meet our goals, we do need you, our listeners, our partners, to respond to the pre-drive mailing which you should have just received in the mail. Take time to read my letter and make your pledge, and then tell others about our special programming beginning on September 10th. To speak to us personally, call Tony at 734-930-5200. That's 734-930-5200, and God bless you.
On the next Cresta in the Afternoon.
Groundbreaking plasma physicist Ian Hutchinson has spent his long career examining the world of physics and biology. He wants to know how we perceive reality. Are faith and science compatible? How do we answer the questions that science can't explain? And are miracles ruled out by science? Those are the questions we answer.
Cresta in the Afternoon from 4 to 6 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Each week we go into the Ave Maria CD library. We pull on a talk or two to see what our Lord might have to say to us. Most of these talks are recorded at area gatherings and conferences. Most of the speakers are nationally known. The topics are varied, but they are all centered on the Lord, and they all are worth your listening time. You're back from Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Why not sit back and join us? Be fed on the Lord. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting On the Mind of Christ on 990 WDEL in the Metro Detroit area and 1440 WMAX in the Saginaw Valley. Putting On the Mind of Christ is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
I'm back with Professor Frank Buckley, who's been on Church and Culture many times. I've got him back today because he's got a brand new book out from Encounter titled The Republican Workers Party, which is a surprising name, but it's explained to some extent by the subtitle, How the Trump Victory Drove Everyone Crazy and Why It Was Just What We Needed. Frank, in your book, you talk about the importance of Trump getting around to connecting with Catholic voters. How important was that?
It was, for a couple of reasons, absolutely crucial. And, if I may confess, this guy, D.L. Hudson, was absolutely crucial in making that happen.
Thank you, sir.
I don't know if I'm letting the cat out of the bag, but you know, really what happened was in terms of, tweeting about Mother Teresa, for example, or...
Yeah, he did that wonderful little video, YouTube video about that.
So he, you know, he did, right, he did all that good stuff. And he, you know, the swing states that were most crucial were states that had big, big Catholic voting blocks. Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. So, you know, that was the election. And the Catholic voters were pretty much smack dab in the middle of the voting blocks. I mean, in the middle of the American voters. I mean, Catholic voters are patriotic. We love America. And, you know, we're not hardcore right-wing when it comes to economics. And, you know, not a few of us have relatives who are policemen or work in the assembly line or whatever. So, you know, we're kind of rooted in ordinary American life. And so we're, you know, and we've been preached at about our duties so often that we don't think about abstract rights. I mean, we didn't hear much about that in parochial school, okay? So, you know, there we are, sort of smack dab in the middle, and without, you know, making a big deal of it, really, Trump did all the things he had to do to reach out to them, and his message was one that was well suited to them. And, you know, and what it wasn't was this. I'll tell you what it wasn't. It wasn't, I'm going to be the president, and I'm going to reform all of morality. And that's the Democrats, right? They were
right.
Going to lead us to the promised land.
Right.
You know, Catholics don't think the state and politicians do that, right? Some people aren't even sure about Catholic bishops now that you mention it, right?
But, I think we have a pretty realistic view of human nature.
We are exactly right, right? It's a great religion for saints and sinners. So, you know, we thought in very different terms about politics than a Hillary Clinton, which was moral reformation. We don't think the state should be reforming morals. And this gets back to the title of the book, The Republican Workers' Party, which is something Trump called it. He said, I'm going to be the jobs president. I'm going to be the greatest jobs president you've ever seen. And that's what we think the state should be doing for us. And that's about it. Give us.
Well, your point, though, is once if you provide jobs, you impact some of the social and moral issues that are always in the background.
Well, that's it. You know, once you have a job, you can think about getting married. You can think about buying a house and having kids. And after that, all the good things happen, right? I mean, we can look after ourselves. We don't need to have a school mom, Hillary Clinton, you know, tap us on the shoulders and tell us what to do, right? We'll take care of that. We'll take our moral instruction from priests, right, or ministers or rabbis. We don't need it from a politician, for heaven's sakes. It's one named Clinton.
We take it from
There's something else about jobs, and that is when you have a job, when you're not dependent on government for a job, you have a sense of independence, which makes you a different person. I've heard people say this about the Second Amendment, right, that, you know, it's not the case that you're going to protect liberty with guns, you know, as against a state that's got tanks, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you have the sense of being independent, you know, if you can carry, that you wouldn't have if guns are taken away from you. And the same is true of jobs. You have a sense that, okay, I can look after myself. I don't need anybody. I'm okay if I've got a job and I feel good about it. And, you know, getting back to libertarians, you know, the libertarians had this neat idea of a negative income tax. Right, right, you know, we don't have to have people working. We'll just give them a basic salary from the government. And I want to say that's horrible, right? Because with jobs comes the things that are valued in life, a sense of self-worth derived from oneself, a sense of community with other workers, and, you know, and the wherewithal to do all the stuff that makes you moral, like getting married and having a family.
Say, John Paul wrote a encyclical on this, on
yes.
work and human dignity.
Yeah.
And by the way, I want to go to one specific thing in your book, and that is what the National Review writer Kevin Williamson said and wrote about you. I find that, I mean, I've always respected National Review. My great aunt was one of the original funders of William F. Buckley's project to create a magazine.
Uh-huh.
She was friends with his family in Texas. And so I got National Review every week until the day she died. But I just can't understand why somebody of that pedigree would come after you with such nonsense, vicious nonsense.
Well, you know, I explained it this way. I said I quite understand why he was so upset. If the Republican Workers' Party was to be born, it was necessary that his party, heartless, ideological, rationalist, should die.
And what does that mean for, what does that mean that those of us who were supporting Trump, what does that mean about us?
Well, you know, Trump is not an ideologue. He's a prudential sort of guy. Catholics are, certainly. I mean, we have very fixed ideas about theology and about religion. But with respect to politics, you know, we're permitted to differ with one another. You know, Catholics are all over the map, you know, in terms of their politics, which is a good thing.
Yeah, called prudential.
Right? I mean, the point I've made before is if you belong to a church where everybody thinks the same way you do politically, do you really belong to a church? Or is it just another form of politics?
Williamson compares the impact of Trump's speeches on the underclass to taking OxyContin.
Yeah. What contempt he showed for people.
Yes.
You know.
And don't you think, so here you have contempt from a writer for the National Review, which he had in common with almost, was there anybody at National Review that was supporting Trump? I don't recall.
They had a few people, Conrad, maybe not in this country, Conrad Black wrote in support of Trump. There, occasionally they'd probably publish Victor Davis Hanson.
Right.
Andy McCarthy was kind of wishy-washy on the subject, half in, half out. But they had set their face resolutely against him. And, you know, I don't know. I sensed a difference from them that I didn't even sense with from some Democrats, you know.
They seemed to be on the same page. And wasn't the American Spectator the only conservative magazine of note that showed support for Trump?
Which magazine did you mention?
American Spectator. You're on the board.
Yeah, American Spectator. Yeah, it was about the only one. You know, by the way, it took a little bit for them to kind of...
You were pushing, prodding. But, you know, you know, in my debates, in my public debates on Catholic radio with a couple of the never-Trumpers in the Catholic world, you know, I put it to them, just like you did. So you would rather have Hillary Clinton elected with all that that entails, whether it's abortion or globalism, whatever, than let a guy who is clearly in sync with us on most issues, and who has the guts to do it, the wherewithal to do it, you would rather hand the country over to Hillary Clinton. To which, you know, they always stuttered. They never really said yes.
Yeah. And you know something? Even in those cases where there wasn't that overlap, I was on Trump's side. I didn't care for the Kevin Williamsons who didn't care about other people. You know, one of the interesting things about 2016, a couple of things. One is all those counties that voted for Obama in 08 that switched to Trump in 2016, that right. wasn't about race. And the other thing is, I found this fascinating. If you had asked somebody 20 years back, what is the most Democratic county in the country, they might have said Harlan County, Kentucky. Harlan County is the seat of the Harlan County Wars. They made movies about this 20 years back. It was a case where that pitted unions, private sector unions versus union bosses. Pete Seeger sang about this, right? And
right.
you were on the side, if you had a moral conscience, you were on the side of the coal miners.
Right.
Well, Hillary Clinton boasted about how she was going to put them out of work. Now, Harlan County, I think, if I recall correctly, went for Obama in 08, but it voted about 90% for
yes,
Trump.
Yes, that is correct.
It's a wonderful story about the abandonment by the Democrats of their base, or what had been their base.
Now, you make the point, which I kind of raise my eyebrows on this one, that we're in a revolutionary moment.
I saw it that way. I saw this in almost the same way that European radicals of 100 years back saw their society in need of a fundamental transformation, a revolution, and what they proposed was not anything one would want. They wanted a pure form of socialism. They never quite understood what they were talking about. They just knew that a transformation of some kind was possible and that we shouldn't accept what we had. The sense that we shouldn't accept what we had is what drove the Trump voters. The idea that you have to accept it was being preached at by our elites right and left. Right? I mean, everybody was saying, wait a minute, you're talking about globalism. You can't push that back. Or you're talking about a high-tech economy, and you can't change that. Those jobs you're talking about, they'll never come back. That's just foolishness. You know,
and the climate change accords.
Yeah,
all these things were supposed to be untouchable, right?
Yeah. So you know, and these were stark. One of the things one saw, which I found really despicable, on the right, amongst libertarians, is the sense of a cognitive elite. And that's why I told a story about that poor, idiotic child when I was a kid. Right? People on the right, people on my faculty, people in the economics department at Mason, have written about the stupidity of ordinary Americans, how they shouldn't be trusted with democracy, how choices should be taken away from them, roughly how a cognitive elite basically should be privileged. I despise that cognitive elite on moral grounds. I see what they've done. I've seen their heartlessness. I'll take my side with the idiot that I remember from grade two, whenever it was. I'll worry about how we treat those kinds of people. That's how you judge a society.
Tell us how all this applies to the Senate confirmation hearings that are going on as we speak.
Yeah. Well, it's one side of a cognitive elite against the other, actually. You know, it's But
is this a kind of hearing that displays America's greatness?
Not quite. It's a good advertisement for not televising proceedings in Congress.
I mean, you're a law professor. I mean, how does this make you feel about, you know,
I teach contract law. I teach about deals that one person makes with another, making both better off. I'm happy to do that, right? Broader questions of policy as conducted by lawyers, that I have no sympathy for.
The
modest things law does is fine.
It's an embarrassment. But here's the final question I want to ask you, and perhaps the most important one before we run out of time. Going forward, what aspects of these dynamics that you described so beautifully in your book that brought Trump into the White House and continues to keep his approval rating high, what has to be thematized, I mean, actually, you know, consciously affirmed as issues or as approaches in the coming election cycles? What are they that have to be affirmed?
Well, that's a good question. I'll be in the White House. I'll visit the White House early next month, and I think what I'll tell them is that Trump should try to return to the themes that got him elected in 2016. They're still there. They're still important. And he too much has allowed the politics of the day to dominate what's going on. He'd show greater awareness of his base if he blew that off and didn't react to things. What we'd like to hear are the themes that got him elected, which roughly is a pride in America and a sense of economic nationalism and identity with ordinary American working people. We'll look after them when they need help. We'll not leave them out in the cold, but mostly we'll try to give them jobs.
And do you think that this is something that the party from the top down is willing to support?
Well, you know, the Republican Party is in a state of shock right now. That's really what's going on. I mean, and Trump is reacting to the people he hears in Congress. There's a presidential Republican Party. I don't know where the congressional Republican Party is. It's slowly coming around to Trump. I mean, the departure of Paul Ryan, I regard as a good thing in that respect. You know, great, you know, he loves Ayn Rand, bully for you, but that's not the Republican Party I'd like to see. I think we'll see more, you know, people concentrating on Trump-like themes. And that's the future of the party.
And, of course, there's also the inseparable issue of style.
Yep.
There are really very few, if any, Republican leaders who have adapted their style toward Trump, and I think his style is as important to his success as the issues he's fighting for.
Right. There is. I get kind of asked this question on occasion. Right. You know, what happens in 2024? And my flip answer is, well, that's Ivanka. We got that one covered. And then 2040 is going to be Bannon. No, but he's an original.
Yeah.
And you have a white shoe party that never quite figured out, you know, what to do with pork rinds. You eat them or whatever. And, you know, and their efforts to look like regular people seem patronizing. That's why culturally Catholics felt usually more at home with the Dems until the Dems decided they despised ordinary people. There's a hole there, and Trump filled it. I guess we're waiting for other people to figure it out.
And the what do you, if you were to prognosticate at all about the upcoming midterms?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I was on CNN just before the last election. I well remember I was opposite some Democratic partisan, and I was being told, you know, as we all knew at the time, Trump didn't have a chance. Why? Well, his ground game was absolutely pathetic. Right? So I keep thinking about the ground game, right?
Yeah.
It didn't matter. You know, the press is completely opposed to Trump, but so many of us have tuned it out. So we won't know until Election Day.
Yeah, I mean, there is so much unpredictability that has been stirred up by the media, really. Wouldn't you agree that there's got to be a toll taken when all but a few major media sources are pounding on Trump every day for 24 hours a day?
Yep. Well, you know, how many newspapers did Trump have on his side in 2016? I think there were three of them. So we've been there before.
It's kind of like how many bishops said anything negative toward Hillary Clinton. About three of them.
Yeah, right. So stand fast, Cragalacci. Let's just hang in there.
Well, I'm going to remind our listeners what the name of this book is and how to find it. It's from Continuum. It's entitled The Republican Workers' Party by F.H. Buckley. The subtitle is How the Trump Victory Drove Everyone Crazy and Why It Was Just What We Needed. And if you put in Republican Workers' Party on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any other retail outfit online, I'm sure you can come up with it. Frank, when are you going to record the audio book?
I've asked the publisher in Canada to get with that. I'd love to do it.
Well, first of all, you had the voice for it and the joie de vivre, but this is the kind of book you would make probably about a 6 or 7 hour audio book, and it would be ideal for it.
With all the craziness that's going on, but this is just sheer fun. Just enjoyable. All the craziness, watching.
Yeah, but, you know, it's crazy, but you've penetrated the surface of it. You've gotten down to the philosophical / spiritual religious lava flow that's under there. And you've really kind of reset the context of the debate and who the players are. You know, the players aren't left and right because, as you put it, Trump adopted the old liberal stance, which the new left has thrown away, but also adopted the social conservatism of today's religious voter, which was the social conservatism of the old liberals.
Yeah.
To me, that's not the way people are talking about the political situation.
The Trump voter is an old-time Democrat.
Uh-oh.
Yep.
Well, you know, when I look back, I was looking back at a speech by Senator Everett Dirksen today at the 1952 convention, Republican, and I was feeling nostalgic.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, he was an old liberal, but he was Republican.
Well, the Republicans, of course, at the time, were right on civil rights. They were horribly wrong on economics, as opposed to Kennedy. But, you know, it's there's a lot to be said for the old Tip O'Neills in the party, the Democratic
yes.
Party.
Right. And wouldn't it be a miracle if someone like that would rise up again? I thought for a while Manchin might be the guy from West Virginia.
Yeah.
No, he flunked.
No, well, that's, you know, we are lucky, Republicans are lucky in their opponents.
Yes. So Frank Buckley, professor at the Scalia School of Law at George Mason University, thank you for your book. May it enjoy the success it deserves. And thanks again for being on Church and Culture.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a ball.
Thank you. To all of you who are listening, we'll have another guest, great guest, after this short message.